WFAE wants to know which question should be answered next on the FAQ City podcast. What is the mysterious four-story glass structure on South Boulevard? Which national chains got their starts in the Charlotte area? Or what is the story behind the gold statue at Providence and Queens? Cast your vote for your favorite question now on WFAE.org. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's May 1st. School is almost out for another year, but school officials are already thinking about next year and a host of other issues, too. School safety is on a long list of topics that include truancy, sex education, the budget, and a desire by Matthews to start their own charter school. We're going to talk about all this and more this hour with Charlotte Mecklenburg School Superintendent Clayton Wilcox, who is in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome back. Good to
Thanks.
See you.
It's good to be here.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also watch us on Facebook Live. Clayton is the guy on the right. We spoke for the very first time, and I think the only time so far, just after you arrived to be school superintendent. Did your expectations of the job meet the realities?
I think it's a little more real than I expected. it's been great, honestly, but the challenges come in huge doses every single day. And just when you think it can't get any more challenging, it does. So, yeah.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that CMS is the largest system that you've been in charge of, or is that not true?
No, it is the largest.
The largest system, and it's one of the largest, I think it is the largest in the state. Maybe Wake County slightly bigger than us.
Wake is slightly larger.
Bigger isn't always better, I suppose, but we do have a good national reputation at CMS. Is there a disconnect between our national reputation among educators and those who follow public schools and the reputation that Charlotte has locally?
You know, it's funny that you say that because I was just talking with some other superintendents this morning in a conference call, and that's exactly the case. When you take a look at our NAEP scores, when you take a look at the things going on in Charlotte, the things that are coming out of Charlotte that are being adopted elsewhere, this district is held in very high esteem nationally. In fact, we are the exemplar district for many in the acquisition and use of technology in our classrooms, some of the innovative structures that we have, for example, opportunity cultures or what we call success by all, where we're paying a differentiated compensation rate for people. Those things are being implemented nationally now.
What are NAEP scores?
They're the National Assessments of Educational Progress scores. It's okay. When large urban markets actually compete and compare against each other. In those cases, we're usually in the top, we were always top one, two, or three. Now we're in the top six in a lot of areas. So we've had a bit of a slip, but, I think that's to be expected that you go up and down a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of scores, you got some good news recently. The system, I believe, ranked number one on national eighth grade math exams. Am I right about that?
That's right. That's one of those NAEP scores.
Okay. And that means you outperformed other large school districts, but the tests also showed that only 41% of CMS students rated as proficient. If only 41% of students are proficient, and we're number one in the country, what does that say about public education in America?
Well, I think it says that we face a lot of challenges.
But why? Is it like that in the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s?
No, I think that's an interesting point because when you take a look at the 1950s, only about 50% of the population was actually graduating from high school. And so I think that was really, today when we have nationally in the 80%, we have kids going to school today that didn't go to school in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of kind of the misnomers. People remember the good old days, but the good old days were only good for some people. You can roughly track the graduation rates by the decade, meaning in the 30s and 40s, only about 30% or 40% of the population was going. That really leveled out in the 70s, about 70%, and only recently we've moved into the 80s.
But aren't we talking about apples and oranges here? Graduation rates are one thing. That's high school. It's 12th grade. We're talking about 8th grade proficiency in math exams at 41% of the students at CMS are performing at grade level, and that's the best in the nation.
Well, I think it's true, Mike, that we are comparing apples and oranges a little bit there, but also I think it goes back to graduation, right? Many of the kids that we're talking about in eighth grade weren't in school in eighth grade. There weren't compulsory attendance laws in some places, and many of the kids who are going to drop out already dropped out into an economy that was much more willing to absorb people without a formal education.
Well, that's my point. I mean, if you are only 40, if only 41% of the student body in any given school in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, and that's the best in the nation. I'm going to keep underlining that because it's not. I'm not pointing fingers at you. I'm pointing fingers at public education. That 41%, that means what? 59% of the students are not proficient.
Well, I think
so. If we're in an economy that requires trained, educated people when they get out of school, what are we doing?
Well, I think I would agree with you that we aren't keeping up with the demands of industry today, and I hear that almost daily. Later today, I'm going to be speaking to Rotarians, and that's going to be one of the things that I know they'll say to me is we don't have enough qualified workers to do the sophisticated jobs of.
But
the,
why?
Well, I think it's a variety of things. I won't blame any one group, but I would say that I think we have kids who are coming to school that are not ready. I think we have kids coming to a school whose parents aren't as invested in their success. I think all education begins at home, but I'm reminded of kind of an old adage that I heard when I was a superintendent in Baton Rouge, that if you point a finger at any one person, there's still three pointing back at you. I think we're trying to do a lot of things today in education that perhaps we didn't do in the past. You know, there's traffic safety that we do. There's, you know, all these different
programs. Are we asking you to do too much?
Well,
we're going to talk about mental health in a little while, and you're asking in the budget for more money from counselors and psychologists. Why the hell are the schools doing that? Why isn't that something that somebody else in a profession does that? Why don't we take these kids and say, okay, you need help. Parents, your child needs help. Here's a company over here, or here's a hospital over here. Why are you doing it?
Well, we do a lot of partnerships. We absolutely do a lot of partners. We have partners with mental health providers. We have partners.
But why are you hiring? Why do you need to hire psychologists? That's not what you do. You're supposed to educate them in how to read, write, and do arithmetic.
Well, our psychologists actually look at test scores. They look at things like the all kinds of issues. They're not just there for mental health issues. They do some mental health work. They do some, kind of program alignment work, but that's not all that they do.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think, Mike, it goes back to we have kids in school today that wouldn't have been in school before. We've had social networks that have broken down. Take a look at mental health counseling within a community. The opportunity for kids to get psychiatric care just isn't there anymore. It's been cut through many cycles of federal budget cutting.
That's my point.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the absence of that, in the void of that, I think we have to step in as a school system and do some of those things. I would rather not, but we have to.
Yeah.
The other thing I might add is, when you take a look at what's going on today in an Algebra 1 class, it's very different than what was going on in an Algebra 1 class in 1950 or 1960. And I'd encourage anybody who's listening to go listen. Now, I'm not saying algebra's changed, but the pace at which it's instructed has changed.
I was going to say I took it three times, so I would definitely fail. There's no question about that. Despite this number one rating, CMS Black students came in at 25% of reading proficiency. Once again, we're number one because the national average is 13% and North Carolina's average is 14%. Okay, we do better. Clearly, though, something is seriously wrong.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that there's something wrong. And I think part of it is self-inflicted. Some years ago, school districts across the country got away from teaching the decoding skills that make it necessary for kids to read. We're only recently getting back into teaching kids phonics, phonemic awareness, teaching them comprehension skills, helping them with fluency. We've actually moved away from things as simple as saying to parents in the pre-kindergarten years, here are the 200 most frequent words your kids are going to contact. Make sure that they know them. We sometimes refer to those as Dolch or early acquisition words. Kids don't know those. Kids don't know how to count to 10 when they come to school. And those were things that kids used to know.
Yeah. Is that because there's no ding-dong school or romper room? I'm serious. On television anymore? I'm serious about that.
Well, I think there is something to that. I mean, I grew up watching that. I watched Miss Bonnie in Romper Room, and that's where I learned some things.
Yeah.
But I also think it's, again, it goes back to kind of this larger malaise of what's going on in our society. Today we don't have a lot of moms that are staying home helping their kids. They're working.
Okay.
Sometimes they're working two jobs. Sometimes they're ill-prepared to be a parent because they have an early pregnancy and they drop out of school themselves, and so they don't have the parenting skills.
You mentioned something I've always wondered about. You said at one point we dropped the teaching of phonics, and I remember when that happened. And I'm just curious about why we keep experimenting with something that's been going on since Aristotle. Seriously, I mean, if it worked for people in the 1840s and it worked, Why do we have to change it? Why was there new math when I went to school? Math is math.
I just think some people who kind of ended up carrying the day thought they had a better way to go about it. They had some results with a group of young people that then we either, you know, kind of change the way we go about things, or we thought, well, we've got to do something different because this is kind of getting tired, it's getting stale.
Not to a fourth grader. They've never seen it before.
I mean, sometimes success isn't sexy, but I think a lot of education today is really kind of something that doesn't need to be. I mean, how hard is it, for example, to teach letter-sound relationships and have kids encounter them? I think it's relatively simple. But, you know, we're just kind of getting back into that.
Because North Carolina has spent $150 million. I don't know when that started, but they spent $150 million to boost reading skills. And this is what we've got. Eighth graders displaying 30% reading proficiency. Fourth graders displaying 40% reading efficiency. Is that money well spent, or are we just tossing it down the drain?
Well, I think for the kids who are doing well, it's money well spent. For kids that aren't doing well, you've got to question the expense. You know, Mike, I'll go back to this conversation that we started with, and that is, you know, we have a lot of kids in school today who wouldn't have been in school before, but we also never had these kind of proficiency exams. We really don't know for sure that these rates have changed significantly over time. We don't know of the 50% of people that were in high school in the 50s. Were they all great readers? We tend to remember that because the people that we surround ourselves are like us, and we all read. But I'm not sure that that's really true for some of the people that my father hung out with at his gas station, that they were all great readers.
Right. So we didn't test like we test today, and we didn't keep data like we keep today.
That's exactly true.
Okay. You submitted your first budget to the county recently. It was described as ambitious. Is that how you view it?
You know, I view it as it's necessary to move forward. We asked for about 5.5% increase over last year, which is about $39, $40 million the way you advertise. We looked at safety and security. We looked at compensation for our teachers. We did look at the social-emotional health of our young people, trying to improve our guidance counseling ratios. We looked at a number of other factors, but I think it's a reasonable request. It's one that we were very careful in constructing. We first looked at what are the things that we don't have to do anymore. We took a look at what do our teachers need and what do they deserve. What do our support team members look at? So we were thoughtful about it. You know, I'm also a realist. I know that the county commissioners are going to take a look at it and say, well, you know, you could do this better, you could do that better, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. But I'm in this battle every single day, and I think the budget's realistic.
It's a $1.5 billion request to the county, I believe. Is that right?
Well, actually, it's a total of $1.5 billion, but the request to the county is significantly less than that. Okay. The county's share is about 30% of
Okay, so this is the total request, state and
yes.
And it includes $6.7 million to hire additional counselors, social workers, psychologists, 5 police officers, 2 locksmiths, and 2 electronic specialists. We have locksmiths on staff?
We do. We do.
Why?
We have one right now because we have a lot of keyed locks. And, you know, quite honestly, it probably is cost effective for us to have a few of them that can run on an emergency situation.
So would it be fair to say that a lot of this $6.7 million is in response to what happened in Parkland?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's a direct response.
Is that what parents want? Have they demanded that?
We've gone across this county. We've had listening sessions, 9 all around the county, and that was the number one concern of parents is keeping their kids safe, both social, emotionally, and physically safe.
Okay. We have to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about mental health issues and school safety and what's going on in Matthews, which I know is one of your favorite things to talk about.
I can't wait.
We'll talk about that with Clayton Wilcox, who's the superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Clayton Wilcox is with us. He is the superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. It's budget time. We've been talking a tiny little bit about the budget. All of the individuals responsible for school shootings, I believe, without exception, had mental health issues. And it isn't just shootings in schools that have people concerned with a lack of mental health care in America in general and schools in particular. suicide, I am told, is the leading cause of death among young people, and that's a mental health issue. Parents have often talked about a lack of sufficient mental health professionals in schools. Amber on Facebook writes, mental health services are needed desperately at schools. Adults have trouble performing at work with mental health issues. Children have the same troubles at school. Mental health services help teach children coping skills in the type of environments where they need them most. How much of the $6.7 million that we talked about in the last segment for your budget request is earmarked specifically for counselors and psychologists?
We're looking at trying to add almost 60 positions. That includes psychologists, social workers, and guidance counselors. About 30 of them are guidance counselors, about 20 social workers, and then 10 psychologists. And they are specifically there to help counsel young people, to talk to young people about the challenges they face. I think, you know, many of your listeners probably don't have a full appreciation for just how challenging it is to be some of our young people today.
Why is it worse than it was when we were kids?
I think
social media.
I don't know that it's worse. Although I will tell you, I think as society, in essence, breaks down along some levels. It probably is worse. So let me back up and say, I think it probably is worse today. I think the pressures on kids today are different than they've ever been. I think when you take a look at when we went to school, the prevalence of two-parent households was probably a stronger thing in people's life. I think people, rightly or wrongly, gravitated more towards houses of worship and churches. Mm-hmm. And so they found some solace there. Whether or not, you know, you agree with that or not, I think it was true. Mm-hmm. And today, I think we have a lot of really pressing things. The economy is much less forgiving to people who don't have an education today. I think people take a look as they walk down these streets of Charlotte and see, I don't have that. Why don't I have that? Even though they don't do the self-reflection and say, I don't have the education that's necessary to be there.
Well, we are bombarded with commercial messages that tell us to buy expensive baubles and tell us that we deserve them.
Absolutely.
And that's hard to get away from. The $6.7 million and the counselors and the psychologists that will pay for, how many will that pay for? In other words, how many do you have now? And in the best of all possible worlds, how many do you need that you're not going to get for the $6.7 million?
No, let me give you just an example. The ratio for social workers today by the National Association of Social Workers to students is 1 to 250. And yet our ratio right now is 1 to 2,119.
Holy cow.
So this will make a small dent in that.
If there were mental health services readily available, and these went away in the Reagan administration, if they were readily available today, would you need to have these people? Or could you refer them out?
I think we could refer most of them out. And, you know, to people who are listening, we do refer a lot of them out to mental health agencies, but not like we did previously, because there just aren't those services available.
School safety, obviously top of mind for a lot of people. The system spent $19 million in the aftermath of Sandy Hook. You weren't here then to harden the schools. Now you're proposing to harden these schools even further at parents' requests. It's difficult to argue with that, but if you had an unlimited budget and could do everything that you wanted to do, just how safe could you make these schools without turning them into prisons?
You know, I think one of the things that we could do would be to consolidate some of our campuses, meaning that we didn't have all these multiple buildings with multiple locking systems and, you know, the challenges that come with multiple buildings. But when we took a look at that, it was going to cost us in excess of $100 million to do those kinds of things. So, you know, we asked for a tenth of that to change doors, to change locking mechanisms, to add camera systems. And earlier in our operating budgets, we'd asked for some people to help with that. I think we could do a pretty good job of keeping intruders out, particularly when we partner with local law enforcement to have resource officers there. But we will never make our schools entirely safe, just like you can't make the church down the street entirely safe or even the studio.
Is it a societal problem, or is it the fact that some of these schools have gotten so big that the city's gotten big, the schools have gotten big to handle the population, and therefore there's no sense of community? There's no sense of somebody pointed out on a previous program that in earlier times you would know your teacher because you'd see her or him at the grocery store. You would see them going to church. church. You would see them getting out of their car in the neighborhood, and you'd talk to them, and you'd get to, they get to know you, and so they could keep their fingers in a lot of different pies, and there was a sense of knowing when trouble was brewing. Today, we don't have that.
Well, I think it's different today. I think it is true what people say, that we've lost a bit of a sense of our larger community. Mm. But there are still smaller communities, and we have to get to them. So, for example, you know, you couldn't tell me, for example, that the Harding football team and those people who watch football weren't a small community within Harding High School. And yet there were other people who weren't connected to that. But they still had a sense of community. And what we have to do is find those community leaders and really create a network of care as opposed to just one kind of blob of care.
So $9 million is part of your budget request, $9 million to fortify schools, and you mentioned some of the things that money would buy: bulletproof doors, locks, fences, cameras, a film to put on windows so that if a bullet were to go through it, it wouldn't shatter the glass. If you get that money and you spend it on those things, how much safer would you say our students, faculty, and staff will be from a random attack?
I think the students in those facilities will be significantly safer, but it won't address all of our 177 campuses. It will address a fraction of them. But we are trying to triage and decide which are our most vulnerable facilities right now. So, you know, I think we'll make a difference with this, but could we do more with more? Yes.
Another part of the budget is $3.8 million for a digital literacy program to provide individualized and culturally relevant material for all students, grades 4 through 12. What do the terms individualized and culturally relevant mean? What does that mean?
You know, one of the things I've talked about...
Is C-Spot Run no longer culturally relevant?
I don't know. It still is to me. I just had some happy memories about education there. I always kind of had a crush on Jane. I don't know. But, you know, what we're talking about is a software program that... allows high school kids to both work individually and collaborate. It's a digital learning platform. When I talk about culturally relevant, really all I'm saying there is that kids see people who look like them doing tasks that our kids would be inspired to do. You can't do that through a textbook because the textbook gets old, you know, and you can keep the topic fresh, if you will, because web-based technology, you can update almost on the fly. And so that's really what we're looking at there, is something for our high school kids to use. It's a unit that's really prepared for them along a specific topic that's tied to the state's standards and our specific learning objectives. But it also gives real-time feedback to the teachers so that they can improve instruction for the kids and assign other digital activities.
So to put it in parlance that I would be able to understand from my school experience, we had, when I was learning to read, we had these individualized boxes full of cards with a story on them. And
the SRA boxes.
The SRA boxes, exactly right. And you'd move up in color level,
yes,
the more proficient you became. And it was individualized to your speed and your retention level. And the same was true with the language labs. When I was taking a language in high school, you would sit there and you would have earphones on and a microphone, and you'd écouter et répéter your French lesson at your speed. Is that what you're essentially doing here, but in a more modern way?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
All right. Teacher pay raises are included in the budget. CMS already augments what the state pays teachers. I know that when you presented this, you said the pay raise you're suggesting comes to $1.98 per teacher workday. From the teacher's perspective, how much is that at the end of the year? Do you know? I don't know how many teacher workdays there are.
Well,
I would have done the math myself. I think I could do that. I'm not sure.
It's about $450 on average to a teacher.
Wow.
It's not significant. I think it's...
Oh, I hate to be cynical, but why bother?
Because I think it's a step in the right direction.
Okay. All right.
I think we have to let our county commissioners know that we're thankful for the fact that they supplement the salary dollars that the state of North Carolina provides. But this is a multifaceted approach. You know, many of our teachers on May 16th will be down talking to the legislature about the state's responsibility. For people who are in our community, they should know that about 60% of every dollar that we get comes from the state. Mm-hmm. About 30% comes locally, and then 10% from other funds, federal funds in particular.
Teachers in West Virginia went on strike and got the legislature and the governor to give them a pay raise. Teachers in Arizona are doing that right now. I think there have been other teacher strikes around the country, but I don't remember teachers going on strike for more pay ever. I may be wrong, but ever. You have your ear to the ground. Is there any talk of that in North Carolina? I know we don't have teachers' unions here, but you know, if you don't have teachers, you can't have school.
I think most
have
of our—
have we reached that point, in other words?
Well, I was on the phone this morning with the superintendent from Durham, mm-hmm. Who said that they have 900 teachers who have now taken a personal leave day to go. That's a significant fraction of their teachers. They may have to cancel school. I know that they're having a meeting, a special board meeting tomorrow to talk about what they do. I think that's a step away from a strike. But I guess what I would say is I understand why our teachers are asking for more money. When you take a look at the average teacher's salary today in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, a 10-year teacher, mm-hmm. they can't afford to buy an average home in Charlotte.
Right.
You know, the average price of a home, according to Zillow, is about $340,000. The average teacher after 10 years here makes under $50,000.
Right.
You know, I don't know how fair it is to ask teachers to inspire kids to that 21st century economy, yet they themselves can't participate in it.
And I don't think it's realistic to expect people to either to be able to attract and retain high-quality people mm-hmm. or to maintain the spirit of those people if they are disrespected. And I think that I shouldn't say this because it's not my job to say this, but I'm going to. I think we disrespect education, and I think we disrespect teachers, and I think when we have conversations about the elite who are educated and we put them in a box that is to be demeaned, that hurts the entire country.
I think it does. I think it diminishes us as a society when we don't value teachers, when we don't value police officers, when we don't value firefighters. But in my world, I'm most concerned with educators. I have a significant fraction of my employees who live below the poverty wage. How can that be? How can we as a community, as rich and vibrant as Charlotte is, say to the people who serve our children, you don't deserve the compensation that would allow you to live amongst us in
Charlotte?
But
to flip that coin, some would say, well, look at the test scores. Look at the 41% proficiency at math in the fourth grade or the eighth grade or whatever those numbers were when we talked about them 20 minutes ago. Why should we pay you more? You're failing our kids.
Well, I would argue the characterization that we're failing kids. We may not be teaching them all that they need to know in terms of the standards, but I think we're teaching them a lot of other life lessons, too, that don't get measured on those tests. I think we're teaching them civility. I think we're teaching them how to participate in our democracy. I think we're teaching them kindness. I think we're teaching them how to get along with others. There are a lot of things that don't get measured. We're teaching them the appreciation for the arts. We're teaching them a lot of things about digital literacy and how to advance an agenda. We're teaching them all kinds of things that are important to being a successful 21st century citizen. But those don't get measured on a reading assessment. You know, they don't get measured on a math assessment or a science assessment. So, you know, I would argue with the characterization of failure. But I would say, can we do better? Absolutely, we can do better. But I want people to consider this. You know, the absence of investment, do they think that will make it better? Do they really believe that charter schools are better than public schools? Some may be, but I think the results are very clear right now that charter schools by and of themselves, while they may be better for some kids, are not better for all kids.
Well, that leads us to charter schools. I'm glad you brought that up.
I did that for you. That's the lead into my comment.
Thank you very much. John on you've done this before. John on Facebook, what do you think about the conservative movement toward private school vouchers and custom charter schools taking money away from public education? Your predecessor said, one of your predecessors said, I don't have a problem with charter schools. They're public schools, and they can do a good job, and they can serve a need. But they take money away from you, and they operate on a different playing field with different rules. That's not fair.
It's not fair. You know, I'm someone who believes in competition. I always have all my life. I've been an athlete. I've worked in the private sector. I believe in competition. But I believe that it does have to be fair. I mean, if they can avoid some of these assessments, then we should avoid them. If they can hire anybody off the street, then we should be able to hire anybody off the street. You know, they, an example, I'm not being flip there. I'm saying if they could hire a scientist who is to teach a science class
who doesn't have a teacher's degree,
then we ought to be able to do that as well. So I think there's those things. But I would say this. I think the charter school agenda, just like some of the other voucher programs that are being contemplated, are trying to kill public education. They are set out from the very beginning to allow people to go to school with people who are just like them. You know, we're struggling with a little bit of that right now in our community.
Yes, let's talk about Matthews. The CMS board and the town board of Matthews have held, I'm told, 16 meetings to talk about House Bill 514, which was introduced by Matthews Representative Bill Brawley. The bill would authorize Matthews to be able to create its own charter school or schools. I'm a little unclear about that. In essence, their own independent public schools. They could still, kids could still go to CMS in Matthews, but they could also go to these Matthews-operated schools. Did this idea originate with Bill Brawley or with the Matthews Town Board, now headed by the mayor of Matthews, who is a former CMS school board member?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. I think it actually began with the previous mayor prior to Paul Bailey.
Okay.
They had a discussion within their town. They had a task force set up. I think Representative Brawley is simply carrying it forward to the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting to me is Representative Brawley has said repeatedly he will do what the people say. First of all, I think one of the things that we know is they didn't really ask a lot of people, and that's troubling. And recently, the people that they have asked have said, no, we like CMS. We want to stay a part of that. If that's the case, I'm not quite sure why Representative Brawley hasn't stepped forward and said we're not going to do this going forward. But, you know, I would say this. I'm not opposed to this for the reasons that a lot of people are. I'm opposed because I think it's bad public policy. I think when you say that you're going to have, for example, a charter school and only let certain people in this case people with a Matthews zip code, and yet other people are going to pay for that and they don't have the right to go, I think that's bad public policy.
And when you say other people are going to pay for that, what does that mean? Because if Matthews starts its own charter schools, one assumes that Matthews residents' tax dollars will go to that, and it will, but you're saying that you fund it.
I'm saying I fund it. Right now, I fund every charter school student in this area.
Okay, we're going to come back and talk more about Matthews and other things, including sex education, with Clayton Wilcox, the superintendent of CMS Schools, when we come back. I'm all choked up. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Clayton Wilcox is here. He's the CMS Superintendent of Education. Before we left, we were talking about Matthews and their desire or their exploration of a possibility of starting their own charter schools. There's a House bill in the legislature that may allow that to happen. It has not yet gone to a vote in the Senate, and we don't know if it's going to become law. And as I understand it, if it does become law, they still have to go through the process of putting forth a proposal, getting that proposal reviewed by some entity somewhere, and then approved, and then they have to start the school. So it could be 2, 3, 4 years down the road, one would think. What do you think is at the bottom of this in terms of the desire to start their own school? Is it desire to keep Matthews kids closer to home and away from the vagaries of the ever-changing pupil assignment plans that CMS comes up with, although the new one just went into effect? Is it because of that plan that just went into effect? Do they just want to avoid travel times? Or is racism at the base of this? 80% of the residents of Matthews are white.
You know, I think that it's really about the fear that people have that they can't go to school nearest their home.
Okay.
At the end of the day, I think people choose to live in a place because of a lot of amenities, but also because they feel comfortable there. And people don't like the fact that their children might be moved outside. But what we've said in our student assignment plan is every student is going to have a close-to-home assignment. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the only students who are leaving Matthews today are those students who are voluntarily taking part in another program or process that they want to take place. So, you know, kids going to Providence High are going there for some of the specialized courses that are there. Kids that are going to South Mech High are going there because they want to be part of that South Mech community. kids going out to some of our magnet programs.
But we have essentially resegregated our schools because of a desire for kids to go to schools close to home. And you can't fault people for that. Why travel 45 minutes to go to school when there's a school down the street that you could easily go to? But it's resegregated our schools because our neighborhoods are fundamentally segregated. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question you may not know the answer to. We were the poster child for integrated schools because of our busing program here. It was court-ordered. It was federally mandated. And when we were fully integrated, did the water level cause all boats to rise? Did it make everybody get a better education, or did some people suffer because of it?
You know, I don't know that anybody suffered. I think it was a net overall positive for this community. Everything that I've looked at said that all boats were rising, that young black families were flourishing, that white families also were flourishing. You know, I have not seen any data on the Latino families, which is our fastest growing subpopulation right now. But I think the days of busing are over. That's just not going to happen. I don't think this board has any appetite for it. And quite frankly, our demographics are so different today. Right. I don't think you could get there if you wanted to.
So how do you feel about the possibility of Matthews getting their own charter schools? What would this mean for CMS and for public school systems around the state if this becomes law?
Well, I think if it becomes law, I think what you'll see is more of it. I think you'll see a small town, perhaps in northern Mecklenburg County, or towns pull out. I think you'll see it happen around this place where wealthier enclaves, people who have moved outside of an urban area, are going to say, you know what, we want our own schools. We're going to go. Mm-hmm. And I think that's bad for all of us.
School board member Erica Ellis Stewart says this marks a tipping point that could change the landscape of education in North Carolina.
This creates a slippery slope of further segregating our school system locally and potentially across the state.
Do you see this as the beginning of the end of public education?
I see this as the starting point that some would like to see the beginning of the end. I think there is a group that really think that the best way to go about improving education is to privatize it. I think there's a lot of self-interest there. They want to make the money that they see that comes with privatizing public education. But at the end of the day, I think public schools are the last great institution of this republic. It is the place where we come together.
And there's a difference between privatizing public education and starting your own private school.
Absolutely, there's a difference.
The difference is you can dip your hands into tax dollars.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do people understand that?
Care? I don't think they understand that. It's interesting, in some of our early conversations, some of the very people in Matthews who are now saying read the bill did not know that Representative Raleigh had inserted taxing authority into that bill. Some of the very people didn't know.
So when school board members warn that taxes may rise in Matthews if this bill passes and they actually start their own charter schools, people didn't know that?
I don't think people knew that at all. I don't think that today.
And they'd also be paying double taxes, because not only would they be paying taxes for their charter school, they'd be paying taxes for CMS schools.
I think that's exactly right. And Mike, here's one of the things where I say that cynicism perhaps lives too deeply in me. I think that's the first step. I think people wanted to see this issue of double taxation raised, because then the next thing they'll say is we shouldn't have to pay the taxes to Mecklenburg County, which begins to erode our ability to provide services.
Well, has the system gotten too big? Because before you got here, there was a move in the northern part of the county to secede from CMS. They didn't want to be part of it anymore. So, and I think even the whole town of Ballantyne talked about seceding from Charlotte at one point. Have we gotten too big? Has the system gotten too big? Would we be better off with Matthews and Mint Hill and Huntersville and Cornelius and Davidson and Pineville having their own individual public school systems?
You know, I'm from Iowa, a state that had about 3 million people and 436 school systems. Every town had their own school system.
Same is true in New Jersey, I believe.
And absolutely, and I've lived in New Jersey. And I will tell you, it is not better. There's more bureaucracy. There is more cost associated with it. I think that, honestly, you know, there is a question of are we too big? I don't know the direct answer to that. but we are really not one monolith. We're multiple systems within a system. We have area offices where associate superintendents lead those organizations. My sense is we can do better, but at the same time, I don't think we're too big. You know, people wouldn't say to FedEx, you're too big, because they want national reach. I don't think people should say to CMS, you're too big, if you want a set of shared values, if you want a set of shared educational experiences, if you want what comes with scale, meaning magnet programs, programs around career technology education and other things. You can't do them on a small scale.
Where charter, and I don't know that, are there charter schools that outperform public schools, traditional public schools?
Absolutely.
Because charter schools are public schools.
Absolutely. And there's some research that, in particular, African American students do better in a charter environment than in a traditional public environment.
So where these charter schools are, in fact, outperforming traditional public schools, is that because of something the school is doing differently, either because they can, because they have different restrictions or lack of restrictions on certain things? Is it because they have better teachers? Is it because they have more engaged parents?
No, you know what I think that it is, and there are some here that are held up. It's interesting to me that, and I'll talk about that in a second, but so let me answer your question directly. I think that they're the result of a self-selecting group. I mean, the parents who choose a charter school are actively much more engaged than the parents who don't. And oftentimes there's an expectation for improved education that goes home at night. And so there's a parent who looks at it very differently than the person who simply goes to their assigned school. Mm. I think that's where it lies.
You talked about shared values a minute ago, and that brought to mind something I wanted to talk about with you anyway. It's sex education. A conservative blogger recently helped organize a national protest against what supporters called, quote, radical, graphic, taxpayer-funded, gender-bending sex education. A loaded mouthful. In your opinion, does anything that CMS teaches in the way of sex education or in the way that it teaches it come close to matching that description?
Not at all. Not at all. You know, I think this is a radical agenda that someone is trying to advance of her own, the North Carolina Values Group. I've gotten hundreds of emails from those folks who say to me things that simply aren't true. We're not teaching an agenda like they might indicate. Do we teach that being tolerant in the 21st century is a value that we should share? Yes, we do. But do we teach deviant sexual acts? Absolutely, we do not.
When I got into this business, I never thought I'd ever have to say these words on radio or even be allowed to, but I'm going to ask you. The conservative blogger that we're talking about, Elizabeth Johnson, says she represents 2 million homeschoolers. These people don't even go to the public schools, but she represents 2 million homeschoolers in America who come from tax-paying households. They are paying for this, that are disgusted by the teaching, and these are her words, of anal sex, oral sex, and masturbation during school hours. Is that part of the curriculum at CMS?
It is not part of the curriculum. I would say it's an outright lie for a blogger to say something like that to inflame her base. The reality is I don't believe that that kind of tired rhetoric even resonates with most of the homeschool parents that she claims to represent. The homeschool parents that I know are kind, decent people who simply want the best for their children. Mm-hmm. They don't ascribe to that kind of thing. And I'm certain by saying this today, somebody's going to write to me, yes, we do. But you know what? Not the folks that I know.
Okay. Protesters were, I think, to have gathered here on Monday or last Monday to protest the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools Welcoming Schools program, which you use to help with acceptance, I believe, of LGBTQ students. What is that program and how does it work?
It's a set of resources that we make available to our families and to our teachers to help them teach how to cope with kids and the cohort of kids around that kid who is perhaps transitioning or has said that, you know what, I am a female and yet they're traditionally thought of as a male or the inverse of that. So, again, this is not a curriculum we teach. It's a set of resources that a teacher can read to better have this conversation.
What if you have a parent who believes that there is no room for tolerance of that kind of lifestyle, or not even that kind of lifestyle, that kind of behavior, this transitioning behavior. That didn't happen in the 1950s and 60s. Medical technology didn't allow it, but that didn't happen. So they just feel that it's not morally right. There's no reason to tolerate it. I don't want my children to have to understand that they should tolerate it. What about those people? How do you deal with those people? Does their child have to be exposed to that point of view?
You know, that's why we don't teach a curriculum. We don't sit down and say, this is the lifestyle that you must accept. What we say to the parents are, when we have a kid, we'll deal with it. Now, can a parent pull their child out of that conversation? Absolutely they can.
But can they pull their child out of that comfortably? In other words, is the child going to be teased or bullied because they can't go to that class because their mommy says they can't go to that class?
Well, the unfortunate reality of, I can't control that. There may be some of that. But all too often what happens in this conversation is not what you described. What happens is that the parent doesn't want their child to be moved, the person who has a difficulty with this. They want the other child removed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's not their decision. And so, yeah, we do have some times when this becomes really dicey. You know, we're struggling with some of those situations right now. But at the end of the day, these kids all have a right to an education, and we're not going to deny that.
You spoke to me about this off the air a little while ago. Congressman Robert Pittenger says, over the last month, I have received reports from local parents that they were not notified of school-sanctioned anti-gun protests, that students who chose to opt out were nonetheless forced to attend, and that high-level administrators helped plan the events. My goal, Congressman Pittenger says, is to ensure that students have the freedom to express and engage with different viewpoints rather than being forced to comply with politically correct ideology. Can you respond to Congressman Pittenger's statements that CMS is taking a side in the gun debate?
We're not taking a side in the gun debate. Do we have people who have different viewpoints in the gun debate in our schools? Yes, we do. We just had that play out at one of our schools recently, which I think is why Congressman Pittenger is engaged. Mm-hmm. What I would say to Congressman Pittenger, rather than launching a federal investigation, he had to pick up the telephone and call, and then he could find out some of the facts about what went on in that particular school. You know, do we have every day people who have different viewpoints on our campuses? Yes, we do. The previous conversation illustrates that. We have people who talk about sexuality in very different terms, but we live that together as a large community. The same is true with guns. I don't think anybody here is saying that the lifestyle of the hunter, the lifestyle of the recreational shooter is something we shouldn't accept or tolerate. None of us are saying that. What we're talking about right now is these guns of war that are making their way into our schools, and that's what kids are talking about. We're not initiating these conversations. They are. They're fearful for what might happen. Mm-hmm. What I've said to every one of my administrative team members repeatedly is, engage your kids, talk to them about what they want to do, and as long as it's peaceful, as long as it's organized, as long as it's thought out, you can have a conversation on your campus about these things.
Let's talk about truancy. We have 2 minutes left. How big a problem is truancy at CMS? Because there is a state law governing what happens to people if they are chronically truant.
Truancy is a big problem for us. You know, in some places on any given day, we might have a significant fraction of kids who simply decide not to come to school. There are some things that we would do in terms of law that we would try to compel. But I think what we really have to do is make school more engaging so the kids want to be there. I mean, that's on us.
A lot is asked of public education today. A lot is asked of our underpaid, underappreciated teachers. What could parents and citizens do in 15 seconds to help, whether they have kids in the schools or not?
I think if they're parents, they can be engaged in their kids' education. They can ask a lot of questions. They can come to school and work. If they don't have kids, they can help come to school as a volunteer. They can tutor. They can read. They can be active folks within our community in terms of advancing education, a community that values education.
Clayton Wilcox is superintendent of Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, a job I never want.
It's a great job, though. It really is.
Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.